I appreciate very much the opportunity to be here, and I want to thank Bruce and the organizers for inviting me and all of you for coming. I started working on this talk in May, and it's been just getting more difficult and more difficult over time, and I decided to use some notes, which I have never done before giving a talk, so I hope you'll just sort of bear with me struggling trying to get through all of these notes. How do you get this thing to
right click on the mouse to advance?
Oh, left one. Left click.
Left click.
Oh, okay. But I'd like to talk about Bert Tanner as a non-traditional scientist. Someone who modeled confronting uncertainty for me. And a little history between Bert and I. Integrity, something I think about is when Bert's name comes to mind. A vice president of marketing, a very unusual one, and how he confronted uncertainty and confronted me with uncertainty. And a few comments to wind up. But some history. I met Bert over 40 years ago. It wasn't actually a particularly eventful meeting. I actually can't even remember the first time that I met him. And strikes me that's a little bit like life is. You know, often we don't know how important some of the events are that we experience at the time we're experiencing them, and we only learn later how important they really are. And Bert is a person who's been very influential in my life. Bert's father and mentor, and someone he emulated a great deal, was my academic father. And we all know that the relationship between an advisor and a graduate student is a lot like the relationship between a father and a son. And so I have felt for a long time like Bert's brother. And Bert's family had welcomed me the whole time. I mean, from the day I walked in there as a grad student, all through my life since I've known the Tanner family, I really felt like a part of the Tanner family. So I not only have a brother in Bert, I got a whole family in the Tanner family. And so I feel a really close connection and have really a long history with the Tanner family. I read this little book that Campbell Scientific put out that Bruce was kind enough to send me last week, and it reminded me a lot of Champ. The way people talk about Bert in here is exactly the way I would talk about Champ when I was working every day with him. I mean, so I think Bert was actually emulating Champ a good deal. I don't know if you can read that, but one of the quotes from it saying, of course, working for Bert wasn't always easy. He could be demanding, stubborn, harsh, insensitive, and generally fun-sucking. And I thought, boy, can I identify with that. When I was a grad student, I could have said that about Champ. But then she went right on to say, he expected a lot, but he gave a lot, knowing that, and her knowing that there was no escaping, she just tried harder and started to grow up. And that whole experience is one I could really identify with. And so struck me that the people Bert worked with every day were just like the Champ Tanner I knew when I was a student and worked with him every day. But the Bert Tanner I knew in my academic career, starting in probably in 77 or 78, was different. That Bert Tanner was different for me. And that's the Bert Tanner I want to talk about. And integrity comes to my mind immediately when I think about Bert Tanner. Bert Tanner was a person of integrity. And we scientists and engineers, and I think of Bert as both a scientist and an engineer. He had a touch of both of these things. But we take a certain perspective on our work. And I think Bert had this perspective, even though you'd have to call him a non-traditional scientist. He had this perspective, which is that we view the world as being governed by physical laws, and we work with all of these various rules that we try to understand, manipulate, for the perceived benefit of humankind. And I think Bert had that same perspective. And a key characteristic that you need to have for this to function is integrity. Honesty and integrity is at the base of science. It's absolutely crucial. I mean, we have to be able to trust what other people are doing. We know that everything that we do is built on what somebody else has done, and if we can't trust what that person has done, we're wasting our time. So we implicitly assume all scientists are trustworthy and operate with integrity. And I felt Bert was that kind of a person. And to me, integrity is the cornerstone of science. And it's not even something science investigates, which is kind of strange. Science is built on a presumption that we can't even really define. If you try to define integrity, you're going to be out for a tough job, which is why science has trouble investigating, because if you can't define things, you can't do science. If you think about integrity, you say, well, let's look it up in the dictionary. It's pretty simple. It's honesty or sound moral principle. Well, what's honesty? Honesty is truthful. That's straightforward. You got another word to work with. What's truthful? Honest. Well, wait a minute. State of agreeing with reality. Well, whose reality? All right. Well, what's this moral principle? Capable of making the distinction between right and wrong. Who's right and who's wrong? All right. What's this principle thing? It's integrity. Right? You're going through the dictionary here, looking up these words, and you come right back around, and what do you have? You got a circular. You haven't defined anything here. Right? Integrity is this kind of a word. It's something we call a virtue, which you can't define. And our science hangs on this thing. Now, we tend to think sometimes of morality as relative. So do we think that integrity is relative? I don't think so. We know what it is, and we know what it, when it, it's not there. So it's not really something relative. And I think that we scientists really believe that truth has to be revealed by the physical world itself and not colored by our biases, our human weaknesses, our self-interest. It's not colored by that. The physical world is what we deal with, and that's the underpinning of science. And maybe this is what we mean by integrity as a scientist. We make observations, and those observations depend as little as possible on our self-interest. And maybe a scientist, that's what integrity is. And we believe that even though we have evidence in quantum mechanics that that's not true. You can't do this. You can't make an observation that's independent of the observer. And this is the fundamental premise of all science. It goes way back to Descartes in 1600. If you can't make an observation that's independent of the observer, science gets shaky. Right? And quantum mechanics has rattled that a little bit. But we scientists are perfectly capable of dealing with contradiction. Right? We just ignore what we really don't know how to deal with. I mean, and that's the way we operate, I think. I mean, I think Bert was curious about these issues because he and I had conversations about these things, didn't always agree, obviously, but these fundamental issues of truth and integrity were really important to Bert, and he worked very hard to maintain his sense of integrity. What you saw is what you got. But at the same time, just like the rest of us scientists, he didn't let it interfere with his work. Right? And after all, if what I'm doing is okay with society, I guess it's okay with me, and you proceed on. But Bert always displayed to me the highest degree of integrity and honesty. And that's something that's important to me. He asked a lot of questions. He's always asking questions. He appeared to be uncertain about a lot of things. These questions were revealing his insecurity with concepts and things that the instrumentation that the company he worked for was making was intimately connected to. And a lot of us scientists were a lot less uncertain about these things than Bert was. I mean, he would probe all the time, and in many ways he knew more than any one of us did because he was talking to all of us. And so he had a bigger, different perspective than we had, and he never let loose of any of these loose ends. Many years ago I thought, well, Bert really just didn't know as much as we did. Bert just really wasn't quite as smart as we were. But I didn't have to know him very long before I abandoned that notion. Bert was a very bright guy. I haven't really felt that way for a long time. I think it was his humility that made it easy for us to think he really didn't know that much. But the Bert Tanner that I knew was bright, humble, questioning, curious, respectful, insightful person with an incredible memory. Bert had a remarkable memory. He could pull back stuff from conversations with your colleagues and just stop you cold in your tracks. And that's an amazing quality for a vice president of marketing, to me. And Bert was someone, I just loved to talk to him, I loved to be around him, and I miss him a lot. And I'll continue to miss him a lot. Vice president of marketing. Whoa, why do I put ouch there? Well, he wasn't like any vice president of marketing I knew. For sure. And, you know, this is his vice president of marketing look. And I often thought I'd like to be a fly on the wall in Campbell at the executive meetings when Bert was there. But we scientists have a saying, you don't believe anybody who's selling something. Salesman or colleague, and I never felt like Bert was selling anything. I really didn't. I felt more like Bert was one of us. And the kind of Bert I saw, very occasionally this Bert, but more often I saw this Bert, the guy who's working shoulder to shoulder with you in the field, digging through everything that you had to solve in order to get things to work as best as was possible to make them work. This is business people you could trust. And I think that made Bert unique in my mind, that trust is a very important issue for a scientist. It's the cornerstone of what we do. And Bert projected this image of trust and I think was the perfect person to be a vice president of marketing at Campbell Scientific. I really do. I'm convinced that he was a remarkable ambassador for that company and the perfect person to be in the position that he was in. Uncertainty was something that Bert modeled for me, really amazing ways. He was aware of how selective we scientists can be. I mean, we got to get the next paper out. We have a tenure document to complete. We got the next proposal to get in. All right, and we're willing to kind of bend the uncertainty issues a little bit to get done what we need to get done. And Bert was pretty aware of this, how arbitrary we could be with uncertainty sometimes. You just kind of push it off, I'll take care of that in the next grant. And really, he would really never let us get away with that. At least he never let me get away with that. And he was always questioning my veracity here. And I appreciated that with Bert. I really did appreciate that with Bert. I mean, one example of that was closure errors. Bert was bugged by closure errors forever. I can't tell you how many conversations we had over beer late at night on the closure business. And the scientific community was slow to accept that this closure error issue. And Bert just kept hammering on it anyway. Not exactly the way you sell instruments to point out one of the shortcomings of the things, but that was his integrity and how he dealt with integrity on the issues of uncertainty for him. Another example was his coordinate transformations. George Thirtle's here in the audience, and I remember him saying coordinate transformations with eddy covariance data was one of the worst ideas he ever had in the 2002 in a symposium. And Bert kept bringing me data and showing me data how these coordinate transformations were just screwing up the fluxes and screwing up the, and he just wouldn't let that thing go. And he finally convinced me, he educated me, that wasn't a good idea to do that, but we still see all kinds of people doing these coordinate rotations. Saw a bunch of them yesterday. I mean, and you wonder, why are we still doing them if the guy who created it said, that's the worst idea he ever had? Now, maybe he was dramatizing a little bit at the time. I don't know. But anyway, I wrote it down. So Bert had a lot of integrity. And he knew that our ego as scientists could be very detrimental to us, and that the human ego is the arch enemy of the scientific method. Really, it's our Achilles heel. The ego, what we will do in the name of productivity and all kinds of other things, it's just amazing. We got all kinds of examples. Lysenko in Russia, who actually had some of his adversaries executed, all right? Famous geneticist Vavilov died in prison because he didn't support Lysenko, or biologists in the Third Reich, or this Cassini-Romer controversy, which set back the physics for 50 years before they realized the speed of light wasn't infinite. The Korean geneticist who fudged his data, or the biotechnologist at Wisconsin who was confronted by a grad student for falsifying data in a proposal. And the classic case of plate tectonics. In fact, one of the little stories in the book that Bruce held up for you earlier talks about how influenced Bert was by the statue of Alfred Wegener. The geologists couldn't accept that a mere weatherman had proposed this theory, and it took him 70 years to come to the realization that this weatherman was right. And so our egos really can get in the way. I'd have you read Bill Bryson's book. It's a wonderful treatment. You really ought to read this book. It'll give you a new view. But these ideas of integrity and ego aren't new. I mean, there's all kinds of books about this in science. There's another good one here to read, I'd suggest for you. So how am I doing? Am I run over?
Yeah.
I've run over, so I'll quit. One thing about Bert, when he got upset, he would just say, at any rate, and go on. Right? At any rate, and then he'd go right on to something else. All I want to do in the remaining few years I got left to do interesting things in science is to live with the integrity in dealing with uncertainty that I learned from Bert. And I know that we have to be very conscientious in science here, because science brings us power. And that power can be seductive, very seductive. And it can allow us to be governed by our egos instead of by our hearts and by the truth as we know it. And so I'm happy to dedicate this to Bert Tanner. This is one of the pictures from the book, which I particularly enjoyed. And that's one of my favorite. So thank you for your attention.
Boy, thank you, John. I want to, it's a little dark in here, and I'm not sure I can quickly turn these lights up, but I would before I introduce June Kim, I was remiss in making a couple introductions. The entire Tanner family is here with us, and they've flown in from all over the place, and I'd like to introduce them, and if you could stand up one by one. Erwin Tanner is his youngest daughter, who is at, great, thank you. Jeez, you got a future, Al. Erwin Tanner is a student at the University of Utah. So she flew in from Salt Lake. I'm going in reverse age order. And her sister, Joy Lynn Tanner, is working in San Francisco, and she had to cancel a very major professional trip to be here. And we're glad you guys can be here. Amanda Tanner is Bertie Tanner's wife, and they're at the University of Vermont. And Bertie Tanner, Bert's son, who was our last invited speaker in the session this afternoon, is here. And then finally, Cookie Tanner, Bert's wife of many, many, many years. So we're thrilled to have you here. Thanks for coming. Our next talk is by June Kim, who has come all the way from Japan. He's on sabbatical this year in Japan, sabbatical from Korea. And he worked with Bert at length in Korea, doing a wide range of studies. And he's one of the people that came from very far away on very short notice to be there for Bert's funeral, which was just over a year ago. So we're very honored to have June with us to talk about his work with Bert.
Good morning. How are you?
Here, we could pull this down if you want.
I'm very nervous. Could you turn the light off? please, Al. Turn the light off, please. You don't have to look at me. You look at the screen. I feel like I'm taking a comprehensive exam because most of you are my teacher, were teacher and are teacher and will be teachers. Anyway, thank you very much. I'm standing here representing myself as well as whole members of Asia Flux, thousands of students and friends and colleagues. As Professor John Norman pointed out, I have been also working on this presentation since last winter, and it's getting more difficult, and I was staying up all night just looking at and trying to delete some slides, but I was not very successful. Anyway, this presentation has two parts, one kind of simple lecture, and then there are a bunch of pictures because I thought pictures probably can paint thousands worth to convey the heart of Asia Flux people to Bert and family and friends. Okay, so the title is kind of awkward because sustaining ecosystems and people in a changing world. Because whether Bert was actually thinking and knowing or not, I don't know. But he has been the role model, and he will be role model in this. So, okay, well, science. Thank you, Professor John Norman. You really helped me a lot. I think there are some redundancy, but I think redundancy is good for actually building resilience. Science, aim of science has been to provide answers for questions about the world and how it works. And long time ago, Francis Bacon wrote, "The end of our foundation is the knowledge of causes and secret motions of things and the enlarging of the bounds of human empire to the effecting of all things possible." And indeed, we have been, scientists and engineers, have been attempting this ever since, especially for the last couple of hundred years. However, the concept of pure science ruled, now it's changing. And science is losing its status as the only means for the effecting of all things possible. On the other hand, society, based on the definition of Oxford Dictionary, is a grouping of individuals characterized by patterns of relationships between these individuals that may have distinct culture and institutions, or more broadly, an economic, social, and industrial infrastructure in which peoples are a part. The challenge is society has been speaking back to science, especially for the last several decades. And unfortunately, or fortunately, science itself had become a rigid paradigm in need of change and is going through an evolutionary process, perhaps the most painful one. And this process is and continue to be disturbing for ourselves, policymakers, decision makers, and the public. We are facing the paradox of flattening world. Thomas Friedman, in his book, the metaphor of flat world supposed to provide us better world through globalization and homogenization, but that's not the case. The global trajectory is really discouraging. And some social scientists elegantly concise, condensed the obstacles causing this paradox into three basic things. First, lack of understanding of the system, in this case, our social ecological systems. And secondly, lack of capacity to perform the actions and changes needed. Here, capacity is defined as willingness to stretch. I think Bert is one of those always willing to stretch or to be stretched. And thirdly, lack of willingness to implement. So what is system? System is an interconnected set of elements which is coherently organized in a way that achieves something. When I actually found this definition from the dictionary, I was really shocked because system has a purpose. So the three pillars of the systems are elements, interconnection, and purpose, or for non-human things, function. So system is more than the sum of its parts. System exhibits dynamic, adaptive, goal-seeking, self-preserving, and sometimes evolutionary behavior. Least obvious, which is the purpose, is the most crucial determinant of its behavior. So the system we're facing, or actually we are in, is a dynamic system. So the definition of dynamic process is a complex system in motion with the external forcing acting on it. So the complex system is social ecological system, which is going through a circulatory connections, feedback, and cross-scale issues. This complex system is in motion toward sustainability. But while the external forcing is acting on it, in our case, that's global climate change and other disturbances. So what is the definition of sustainability? Actually, we've been talking about more on sustainable development, but we should talk about more on sustainability development. And I looked up dictionary and found many definitions, but this definition was really making sense to me. Sustainability is a cultural adaptation made by society, including ourselves, as we become aware of the emerging necessity of non-growth, so that underdeveloped, least developed countries can grow and be granted with quality of life and sustainability. So Asia Flux is a community with a mission to bring Asia's key ecosystems under observation to ensure quality and sustainability of life on Earth. And we have a vision. We want to serve as a science frontier, becoming an agora in carbon, water, energy cycle in Asia through developing and transferring knowledge characterized by consilience, the unity of knowledge, and contextualization. Not only scientific implication, but also application and cultural diversity, building resilience by welcoming diversity and conflict, tolerating ambiguity, and embracing paradox through teaching and learning. Sounds familiar? Professor John Norman just went through how Bert has been role model in this. A community with such a vision as iron sharpens iron will enable us to understand parts and see the interconnections, encourage us to be creative and encourage us to reweave the community and take our place, proper place in it, and reach out. That was one of the characteristics of Bert. With our whole person for true relationships, which will reform us and the world in the original image of beauty and love. So, sustaining ecosystems and people in a changing world, our hypothesis is that it will require individual and institutional ability to see with discernment and capacity to respond to surprise and crisis, to learn and store understanding and be prepared and adaptive to allow for change. And social scientists, again, elegantly summarized how to build resilience and adaptive capacity in social ecological system. Learn to Live with Change and Uncertainty, again, pointed out by Professor John Norman. Nurture Diversity, Combine Different Types of Knowledge, which is consilience, and Create Opportunity for Self-Organization. And actually, King Solomon, a long time ago, summed up in his book called Proverbs, chapter 24, verse 3 and 4. He says, by wisdom, a house is built, and by understanding, it is established. And by knowledge, every chamber is filled with all precious and pleasant riches. And here, wisdom is the ability to see with discernment, to view life with eyes of both mind and heart, maintaining a broad yet accurate view of life. Understanding is a skill to respond with insight, gaining a full awareness of situation that result in an insightful response rather than a surface reaction. Knowledge is the willingness to learn with the perception, discovering and growing. Becoming acquainted with the facts and grasping their significance so that ignorance is dispelled and truth is continually pursued. So, building characters and memories. Here, all the precious and pleasant riches, those are the characters and memories, as John Norman said, it's integrity. How we can build that up? By raising up functional groups, knowledge carrier and retainers, interpreters and sense makers, networkers and facilitators, stewards and leaders, visionaries and inspirers, innovators and experimenters, entrepreneurs and implementers, followers and reinforcers. And I think all the presentation today will show how BIRD has faithfully served as a functional group introduced here. So that was the first part of my presentation. The second part will start. Give me a few seconds.
Against the water. Now I'm waiting, if you please. We've longed to see the roses, but never felt the thorns, and bought our pretty crown. But never paid the price. Find me in the river, find me there, find me on my knees with my soul laid bare. Even though you're gone and I'm cracked and dry, find me. I'm waiting here. Now I'm waiting, if you please. didn't count on suffering. We didn't count on pain. But if the blessing's in the valley, find me in the river, find me here,
thank you, June. Very, very nicely done. One of the people that Bert seemed to go way back with an awful lot of people, and I want to tell you that it comes out in Cache Valley, Utah. There's about 20 people that all of us say, Bert's your best friend? I thought he was my best friend. And he made everybody feel like that. One of the people Bert once told me he worked with as a young student was Champ's first graduate student, George Thurtle. And I tried really hard to get George to give a talk at this, but he was resistant, but he said, this is no problem at all because I've got other people that would love to talk. So we're honored to have Claudia Wagner-Riddle come and talk to us about the meteorological connections that Bert had with Guelph, which also go way back, long time.